had he not hit the trees and landed out on the highway 50 feet away, it would have been a much grimmer situation.
A small plane crashes after takeoff in Kodiak. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 15th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, tough times with the state's Volunteer Defense Force.
It's dwindled from 350 or 400 people a few years ago down to about 100 or so now, from what I understand.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards, working with school districts statewide to bring innovation to classrooms through digital learning for the 21st century. Information at aasb.org.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
A small plane crashed early this afternoon after taking off from the Kodiak Airport. The three people aboard the plane, a pilot and two passengers, are safe after an hours-long ordeal where the plane was standing nose down in some trees across from the end of the runway. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the plane, which was identified as a Servant Air Britain Norman Islander, was bound for the village of Old Harbor.
Upon takeoff, it hit the top portion of some trees that were at the end of the runway, and it crashed about 50 yards past where the main road is crossing the runway out front of it. Three people were on the plane at the time it went down, the pilot and two passengers.
The crash closed the road around the west end of the Kodiak State Airport for several hours as Coast Guard emergency personnel worked to stabilize the aircraft and extract the occupants. Base Assistant Fire Chief Mike McDonald said the wreck could have been much worse.
It nosed into the spruce trees and impacted the ground, but it was the trees that it impacted initially certainly added to a lessen of an impact. And it's in my opinion that had he not hit the trees and landed out on the highway 50 feet away, it would have been a much grimmer situation.
The other three fire departments in town responded to the accident as well. One person was extracted from the wreckage by 2 p.m. and transported to Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center with unspecified injuries. The other two reported to be conscious and alert, remained trapped in the plane until around 3 p.m. when they were freed. The last person out of the plane was the pilot, who is still unidentified. He reportedly walked out to the road on his own and refused medical treatment. In January 2008, a Servant Air Piper Navajo Chieftain crashed into the water off the other end of the Kodiak runway, killing six, including the pilot. The cause of that accident was determined to be a faulty latch on the front end baggage compartment, which caused the door to fly open shortly after takeoff. A dispute over the role of the Alaska State Defense Force has been bubbling for some time, although recent changes in command at the State Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has brought it to the foreground. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Alaska State Defense Force is the least known of the state's law enforcement agencies. The state militia was established by the Alaska Constitution. But times have changed, and according to Timothy Flannery, a Big Lake teacher and major in the ASDF, the force has been ordered to stand down, and some of its members are feeling snubbed.
Actually, that's a very good assessment. A lot of them don't feel appreciated for the time and effort, hours and years they put into it. They train for a specific mission that many feel was dictated by statute, and now that mission's being changed, and as a result, it's dwindled from 350 or 400 people a few years ago down to about 100 or so now, from what I understand.
The members of the ASDF are uniformed, organized, pay for their own training, and are called upon in emergency situations to bolster local law enforcement. Flannery says they stand at the ready if earthquake or other disasters befall Alaska.
These are folks who just wanted to help out. God forbid there should ever be an emergency or some disaster. And they have helped out in the past at the Miller's Reach Fire and Willow Flood, Hooper's Bay Fire, and different things. And this is a mission that we trained for and joined for, and A lot of people are unhappy because they do not feel that the way things are going now, there'll be much of a mission for them.
The ASDF, when activated, serves as an additional state police force, which operates at the governor's discretion. The militia takes its orders from National Guard Brigadier General Thomas Katkus, who is at this time undergoing confirmation hearings for his appointment as Adjutant General of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Governor Parnell appointed General Katkus to fill the vacancy left when Lieutenant General Craig Campbell was sworn in as Lieutenant Governor last year. In his new role, General Katkus commands the Alaska National Guard and oversees the Alaska Division of Homeland Security. He says the ASDF is a valuable asset.
So the real strength out of the State Defense Force isn't a specific operational capability, but rather their institutional knowledge and capability that they bring to bear through their experience, their dedication, and their desire to be involved.
But General Katkus says the force is not Police Standards Council certified.
Any portion of the militia ordered by the governor becomes an additional police force, but that doesn't mean that they are cops out there with guns and that's their primary duty. It depends on how they are tasked through the Adjutant General at the disaster.
And changing times means changing tasks. General Katkus says there has been no order to stand down, but changes within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs may have caused misperceptions.
What I'm trying to do is try to figure out a way to fit the capabilities and the great attitude and the ready and reliable resource of the Alaska State Defense Force into this new paradigm of a changed response force.
General Katkus says active duty personnel have to move to different postures as different kinds of threats emerge. And since 9/11, civil support teams are needed, which are versed in technology, chemical, and high explosive issues, and that the work ahead involves developing defense forces which fall into response capabilities needed by the governor in the face of emergency. Flannery says there's a place for the Defense Force in its original role, despite the similar role of the National Guard.
Having people, local people in the communities who people know, who know the territory, who literally are minutemen who can pick up their bags and their equipment and go at a very short notice to help out, is a really important resource for the state of Alaska in terms of helping their communities.
Flannery tendered a request for retirement from the ASDF last week. He says the force, by statute, is meant to act as a police force in times of public emergencies. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A bill that would kickstart work on an in-state gas line from the North Slope to Rail Belt communities is getting its final review before going to the House floor. The bill by Republican Speaker Mike Chenault would combine studies already done by various state agencies, turn the final development over to a new team of leaders, and set a deadline for plans in July of next year and another deadline to see gas flowing in 2015. In presenting his plan to the House Finance Committee, Chenault said his bill is not an attempt to impede the large gas line under development to North American markets, but he says the state needs to be ready for whatever happens to that project.
Alaskans think it's time, Mr. Chairman. They think it's time for in-state gas. They want security in their energy form. And they want jobs that are associated or could be associated with the project.
Early studies have shown that gas delivered through a direct line providing service to South Central and Fairbanks would be much more expensive than taking gas off the large gas line or a GIA project. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra told Chenault that his biggest concern is that customers could be contractually locked into the higher rates.
What do I say to my consumers if I've obligated them to gas through this line and all of a sudden in 2025, gas at half the price starts flowing past them and they're not allowed to access that because they're obligated to the higher price gas on this line.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, what do you tell your constituents in 2015 or 2018 whenever they run out of gas?
Bob Swenson, the governor's in-state gas line project manager, said his office is already doing much of the work called for in the bill. He calls the work already underway insurance for whatever happens to the bigger project, and it can be done jointly with those developing the big line.
I think the investment that the state is making currently is a reasonable investment for that insurance. And that's why the governor is so focused on us getting this work done and getting it done in a timely manner.
The bill will be back before the Finance Committee, but it hasn't been rescheduled yet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Iditarod musher who resists the temptation to check the standings.
I totally do my own thing. I don't bounce off anybody else's game plan. I completely focus on my team and my progress alone.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
Lance Mackey is in command of this year's Iditarod, less than 10 miles from the Golovin checkpoint. Hans Scott is chasing him, about 15 miles behind, but his team is running faster, according to GPS. Jeff King pulled out of Elam about 50 minutes behind Gott. He told the Anchorage Daily News he won't catch Mackey now unless Mackey makes a mistake. Farther back, Ken Anderson, Hugh Neff, and John Baker are all on the trail to Elam. Away from the spotlight that is directed toward the front runners of the Iditarod, other races are taking place. Mushers in the middle or back of the field might be trying to climb up a few positions in the standings, or they might be challenging themselves just to keep moving down the trail. Iditarod rules demand that mushers remain competitive, but what that means depends on who you ask. APRN Iditarod Trail reporter Tim Bodoni has more from Galena.
Rule 36 in the Iditarod rulebook is perhaps the most controversial of all. It states that all teams must be competitive and gives race officials the right to withdraw a musher from the race if the musher is not making a valid effort to compete. The rulebook quantifies the concept by setting time limits by which a musher has to reach certain checkpoints. But for the mushers themselves, especially those in the middle or back of the pack, the notion of competition is subjective. Mushers can often be seen poring over race updates at checkpoints, looking at how fast other teams are moving. But some mushers, like Iditarod rookie Dan Caduce from Fairbanks, claim to ignore the standings.
Oh, I try not to look at it at all and just realize we've got a long ways to go. And you could go way up or you could go way down. And just keeping your team moving smooth is what's important.
Four-time Iditarod winner Martin Boozer also believes in ignoring the standings. While preparing to leave the Galena checkpoint on Saturday afternoon, Boozer compared long-distance mushing to competitions in which individual contestants race against the clock rather than each other.
I totally do my own thing. I don't bounce off anybody else's game plan. I completely focus on my team and my progress alone. And that's why I'm so pleased with this race so far, because I've been able to do that. Sometimes you fall victim of thinking you have to look at other people's times. But lately I've come to explain the Iditarod as a time trial in bicycling without the coaches. We have to be the coaches ourselves. We have to do what's right by the dogs. We don't get splits as we're going down the trail. And we only do what we absolutely can do with our team. So I shouldn't really pay attention to the rest of the guys, because I can't influence them.
Talkeetna musher Gerald Sousa has run the Iditarod each year since 2002, finishing as high as 16th. His stop at Galena on Saturday was not part of his original race plan, but temperatures near 40 below convinced him to abandon long runs in favor of shorter ones and more time at checkpoints, where caring for dogs is easier. He describes a typical Iditarod experience as a balancing act between competing with other mushers and taking good care of your own dogs.
Oh, absolutely. It's a race within a race. If it was a camping trip, we'd do a camping trip. This is a race, and everybody is in it for the race. It's personal pride for the kennel and for the individual. And for us, at some point, we just kind of pull the race plug and then back off and get the dogs happied up more by giving them more rest.
Michelle Phillips from Whitehorse is making her first Iditarod run this year after 5 career finishes in the Yukon Quest. She agrees that all mushers are on the trail to compete with each other, but in comparing the Quest to the Iditarod, she finds Iditarod more conducive to what she calls immersion into your own little dog world. Most of the Quest checkpoints are accessible by road, and handlers are allowed to help Quest mushers feed and care for their teams. Philip says that more contact with family and helpers during a race is a good thing, but it also brings some distractions.
Quite often on the trail we have, you see your kids and then they're having a fight with someone, or you know what I mean? Or you're worried about the truck, that it's going to break down, because that happens all the time, especially on the Yukon Quest for some reason.
Overall, mushers at all levels assert that when you finish is not as important as how you finish. For any musher that plans to come back to Iditarod, finishing with a healthy and excited dog team that will want to go through the whole experience again is a primary concern. Reporting from Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
Staff with the U.S. Senate and Natural Resources Committee were in Southeast last week taking public testimony on the Sea Alaska Native Corporation's effort to complete its land selection. Meanwhile, the small community of Port Protection on northern Prince of Wales Island is opposing the Sea Alaska Native Corporation's effort to select land on that part of the island and wants U.S. senators to come to Southeast Alaska and hear their input. From Member Station KFSK, Joe Vicnicki reports.
The community of around 60 people is near Tongass National Forest land on Prince of Wales that the corporation wants to select for logging. Legislation before Congress would allow the regional Native Corporation to complete its land entitlement under the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The latest bill would allow the land selection from northern Prince of Wales land and other parcels outside of the original areas specified in the 1971 legislation. About 25 Port Protection residents turned out to a special meeting at the end of last month and unanimously passed three resolutions on the issue. Judy Magnuson is the treasurer and secretary for the board of the Port Protection Community Association. She says one resolution requests official hearings on the bill.
We're having these hometown-style meetings, but we don't really feel that they're adequate to address all the different aspects of this bill that we feel really need to be addressed.
The 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, requires the government to hold hearings on land decisions that might impact subsistence gathering, hunting, and fishing use of public land. Another Port Protection resolution voices opposition against the corporation making its land selection from outside of the 1971 ANCSA withdrawal areas. Magnuson says the community supports Sea Alaska finishing its land entitlement selection, but opposes their selection of this particular land. In particular, she says that part of the island has unique karst land, or caves, that are formed by the dissolving rock.
This area that they have selected is 71% of the selection is on karst, and that karst right now is protected with the federal cave Resource Protection Act, and it will lose that protection. And the karst has been shown to be critically important for fisheries as well as for wildlife.
A third resolution passed by the association resolves to join other communities on Prince of Wales and Kosciuszko Islands in opposing the bill. Magnuson says the community has been writing letters in opposition to the legislation for about 4 years. Rick Harris, Executive Vice President with Sea Alaska, says the resolutions highlight the community's concerns, and he says the corporation will try to address those concerns.
The whole access provision was very much driven by the concerns primarily in the Point Baker Port Protection, Thorn Bay, Kaufman Cove area, and so we made an unprecedented decision to allow public access on otherwise private land. So it's unqualified. The public has right of access to that land.
Harris says the corporation has made other adjustments to its selections to answer concerns from local residents, and he says careful logging will not impact the island's karst land.
With just good logging practices, a good ground deflection, careful treatment of the soil, you can effectively log in those areas without interfering with or causing a problem with the karst.
Alaska's congressional delegation has sponsored the legislation in both the House and Senate, and the Senate's version of the bill is in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where Lisa Murkowski is the ranking Republican. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Republicans in the U.S. House agreed last week to a one-year ban on all earmarks, but Alaska Congressman Don Young says he does not support his party's decision. Young says he'll keep trying to secure funding for specific projects.
I've been elected to represent my people, and I'm going to do that. And if they ask me, I'm going to do my best to fulfill their obligation, my obligation to them, to respond to their needs.
A day earlier, Democrats chose to ban earmarks to for-profit companies. Young complains both parties are playing politics, not trying to make a real difference.
This political posturing. The Democrats came out with they're going to give earmarks only to nonprofit deals, municipalities, et cetera, which are most of my earmarks. Like the Bridge to Nowhere is a municipality earmark. Then the Republicans came back and said, we won't have any earmarks, period. There'll be a moratorium. Now, I argue that if you read the Constitution says only the Congress has the right to spend money and to appropriate money and to collect money, not the president or bureaucracy.
Last week, the leader of House Republicans, Ohio Congressman John Boehner, called earmarks a symbol of broken Washington. An Alaska seafood processing company that specializes in high-end products is taking an innovative step to find qualified employees. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Copper River Seafoods is opening a 10,000-square-foot training facility in Anchorage to help the company fill seafood processing and administrative positions at its facilities in Anchorage, Cordova, and Togiak. Copper River Seafoods is a well-known processor of high-end salmon products, and just last year they entered the Bristol Bay salmon market. The company's chief operations officer is Joe Egamo, who's spearheading the effort to create something called the Copper River Campus.
We're always talking about jobs and training. What better way to do that than train people here in Anchorage and then retrain them in the communities that they live in so that they know the way that we take care of fish here in Anchorage and they can see more of the whole infrastructure and the logistics, the accounting, and the processing, of course, how we take care of fish up here in Anchorage.
Copper River Seafoods plans to have the facility up and running in time to help fill skilled positions this upcoming salmon season in Alaska. In 2009, Copper River Seafoods joined the traditional Council of Togiak in creating Togiak Seafoods, which is based in the village of Togiak. That venture was basically Copper River Seafoods' initial foray into the Bristol Bay market, but the company is well known for processing and marketing salmon from other areas of the state. During the salmon season, the company has about 400 employees, and Egamo says the new training facility grew out of the company's frustration in finding qualified workers. Egamo stressed that he's not talking about entry-level processing jobs on the slime line.
The jobs we're talking about are real career moves. We're talking about administrative jobs. We're talking about management jobs, logistics jobs, engineering jobs, construction jobs. It makes sense to have people that live in the communities doing those jobs.
Copper River Seafoods is working with organizations like the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation to identify potential workers that can take advantage of the new Copper River campus. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Students from across the southern Kenai Peninsula are about to get their hands on some high-end digital photography equipment thanks to the efforts of the Homer and Soldotna Rotary Clubs, the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, and a collection of private donors. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
The effort began with Soldotna attorney and Rotary Club member Joe Cashai. On the heels of a similar effort in 2008 that delivered digital camera equipment to schools on the central Kenai Peninsula, Cashai and his wife, Therese, decided to try to do the same thing on the southern peninsula.
The crux of the project is to help do cultural documentation in the various cultures of the south peninsula, including the various native cultures, the older homesteaders, and the Old Believer Russian cultures.
Cashai, who is also an avid photographer, says human beings, especially children, are well adapted to recognizing visually depicted information.
That's why we do things like charts and graphs, in business presentations. We tend to pick up stuff visually more effectively than we do purely from the written or the spoken word. When you combine visual and spoken or written words, the percentage of information retention is far higher than it would be if either one of them was used alone.
So the Cashi family, the Soldotna and Homer Rotary Clubs, and a group of private donors got together with the school district to figure out what kind of equipment would be needed and what it might cost. A few weeks later, they had a list of stuff, including digital SLR cameras, printers, video and computer equipment, and a price tag of $30,500. Thanks to a $15,000 matching grant from the Rotary Foundation, the group was able to make it happen. School District Superintendent Dr. Steve Atwater says the school district is very appreciative of the Rotary Club's efforts.
It can be a real boost for the kids at our schools across the water in Nanwalek. I know that I was over there last week, and they're looking forward to getting the equipment. They're hoping to infuse a lot of cultural images into the school building as a way to build a sense of ownership by the students with the school. So they're really optimistic that that'll make a difference, and I think it will. I think it has a lot of promise, and certainly there's going to be a lot of good energy to make that move forward.
Cashi says the project is moving right along.
We're looking at placing our orders for equipment in the next week or two, and then as soon as that's in, it's been checked out, logged into the school district's database. I'll probably spend a week or two calibrating a lot of the cameras, testing them to make sure they all work. And then we'll get them shipped out to the different South Peninsula schools.
The equipment will be provided to students at Nanwalek, Port Graham, and Susan B. English schools, as well as Homer High School and McNeil Canyon Elementary School in Homer. Soldotna Rotarians will set up and calibrate the equipment and will provide technical support and training for school personnel. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tim Bodoni in Galena, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.